presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Dilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas, con información de Nilufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
To This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
Blues ain't culture. They sounds of oppression against the white man's game he's run on us all these blue years. Blues is struggle, strangulation of our people, cause we couldn't offer the white mother socking it to us. But now, when I hear Billy's soft, soulful sighs of Am I Blue, I say, no, sweet Billy, no mo'. No more blue trains running on this track. They all been derailed. Am I blue, sweet, baby blue, Billy? No, I'm black and ready.
Dr. Martin Luther King. Thank you very kindly, my very dear friends. These churches are really loaded tonight. Never in the history of this nation have so many people been arrested for the cause of freedom and human dignity. You know there are approximately 2,500 people in jail right now. Now let me say this, the thing that we are challenged to do is to keep this movement moving. There is power in unity and there's power in numbers.
be some way out of here. Said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine. Plowmen dig my earth. None of them long in line. No wood any of it is worth. must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, flymen dig my earth. None of them long in line, no wood. We'll be right back.
set by the sea of motorized people, where children live for love and food. There's no
coming up next on the stream of free radio at, well, freakradio.org. It's also archived. It's the Bathrop Spears Broadside Show of November 16th, 2023. This one, of course, is another flashback. It's the Thursday regular. But for those who despair of ever hearing anything relevant and contemporary, probably should continue to despair. But Well, yeah, because this really isn't relevant, but in a way it is. I had a long interview with a former council member and activist, Drew Glover, who was a council member who was, I guess they tried to censure him, and then they recalled him. But I remember him for his work struggling to address homeless civil rights and homeless shelter needs. And you get to hear me talking to him from, I think it was either Louisiana or Alabama. So that's going to be happening on Sunday. So tune in then. That'll be next Sunday, the 17th, 18th, 19th. There's that. And who knows, may also do a long, the rest of the interview with Foundering, the guy who sang songs too nasty to play on the radio and too nasty to allow on the internet and not allowed to be heard. And he's a Santa Cruz local, and I don't always agree with him, as I continue to say, but nonetheless, I certainly agree with his right to be heard and the right of us to hear him. In any case, what you're going to be hearing is a flashback all the way to May, it looks like May 9th, 1999. Yeah, I actually got that right. It is May 9th. And that's in the middle of the Führer Clinton, that's President Clinton, for those who like such titles. That's the, you know, the Monica Lewinsky guy, Bill Clinton. He was president. He was bombing Kosovo, and we were organizing against the bombing, many of us. And we also were in the midst of on the 24th day, on this particular day of the netcast, or the broadcast, actually, then, we're on the radio, of Lou Rice's Hunger Fast protest demanding decent food and other reforms at what is now Housing Matters, was then called the Homeless Services Center, but what I used to call the Homeless Lack of Services Center. You get to hear about his conditions there and people calling in, because we had actual incoming phone calls. We hear from Puck, another broadcaster who called in to give a discussion of his reaction to the situation that Lou Rice was exposing. There was a town hall meeting with the Beach Area Working Group involving Norma Tasker and also myself talking about the boardwalk home demolition plan. I talked about, in a further section of the flashback, the 7 points of Lou Rice, called repeatedly for a protest against the sleeping ban downtown. Bob LaMonica gave a long, well, not that long, a denunciation of former DA and now, I guess then, I'm not sure if he was judge then, but he became judge soon and he became a corpse because he died. But that's, of course, the fate that awaits us all. Then you get to hear stories about the Riverside police killing. The DA won't charge the cops there for that. The use of depleted uranium, toxic depleted uranium in weapons in Serbia, the war that Clinton funded and initiated. We get people volunteering to transport fruit from UCSC down to homeless folks. Linda LeMaster calls in with a legislative update. I caw at the Citizens Police Review Board, the CPRB, talking about Officer Garner's arrest of Steve Argue for doing the perfectly legal activity of selling the street newspaper and the police department's cover-up of that under former Chief Steve Belcher. And we have cops surveilling anti-war protesters and Jim Costner talking about a May 13th protest commemorating the memory of the MOVE victims, the black family that was burned alive in Philadelphia by the Philadelphia police. Wild and crazy. And that's the May 9th, 1999 flashback you can hear if you keep listening. I do want to warn you that some of the musical sections are distorted. I think they were originally okay, but they got transcribed badly. You can skip through them if you find them too hard on the ears. I would recommend you, I like the songs, but then again, that's me. So use your own judgment. But the spoken sections are pretty clear, and I think they're good history. I think they're accurate history. And they're my perspective, of course. But if you're interested in homeless history in Santa Cruz, I think that these netcasts now, they were broadcast then, are a good place to begin, or a good place to at least take a peek in there. Also, a better place, if you haven't got the time to listen to audio, or if you prefer not to, is to go to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, all one word, small letters, santacruz.org. And you can actually read a lot of stories about them and also get the comments of critics and trolls and supporters, although that doesn't go back to 1999. It does go back 2005, 2006, and you can actually find a link on the Huff website now, relatively recent link, a little hard to negotiate, but you can also go to the actual indiebay.org website itself and just put in the name, well, whatever you're looking for, but if you want to read my articles in quotes, put in Robert Norse and you'll be able to see the stories show up. So that's it. Enjoy the flashback and join me again on Sunday when I hope to have some at least little snatches of what's going on here or what's unfortunately not really going on here. That's really more of why I'm not doing a lot of stuff, because I'm not doing a lot of the activism I used to do. And if other people are doing it, I'm not hearing too much about it. So keep me informed, and insofar as I do occasionally put stuff on, I will help to inform others, I hope. Phone number is 831-423-4833, in case I haven't already said it. And, do that. And if you listen in to the flashback, you might find some interesting stuff. You certainly will find some historical stuff from 25 years ago, which may be both depressing and exhilarating. Who knows? Anyway, let your ears be the judge. And rolling off the audio press for you shortly is Bathrop Pierre's Broadsides of the November 11th, 2023 edition, which is going to be, frankly, mostly a flashback, which I try to avoid on Sunday, but I may not be able to avoid it today. Pretty weary, and, well, we'll see what happens, but you may hear me snoring on the mic. We'll see. There's also, well, the flashback is going to be from 2010, February 24th, I believe. I'm tending to get the numbers and dates wrong on these flashbacks, but ultimately they get corrected. If you want to actually read a summary of what the flashback says without having to listen to the whole 2 or 3 hours of it, you can go to the Huff blog, the full Huff blog, and you can find a sort of a brief description of the high points. So, and that usually is written some days later, so I have time to wake up and make the corrections that are needed. Anyway, let's get into the intro.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing. sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin with a story that I noticed in the November 6th San Francisco Chronicle about a week ago. It's headlined, Homeless APEC, a Challenge for San Francisco. City treads carefully for the biggest international event since 1945. This is a big shindig with the APEC organization. I'm not quite sure what APEC... here's what it stands for. Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. So the city mommies and daddies, or I should say politicians, want to make sure that everything is spruced up and cleaned and looking nice and tidy for the foreign visitors who don't want to get the idea that San Francisco is overrun with squalid conditions because of the city's refusal to provide adequate services and shelter for folks outside, and is really simply concerned with servicing the profiteering of the rich. And the reason I find this particularly relevant is because here in Santa Cruz, we have this situation where winter is developing, it's getting colder and wetter, that's due in the next week, and there is no plans for any kind of winter shelter that you can walk in, which has traditionally been the case, where you could walk up to a line and get into the shelter on a nightly basis. You didn't have to be a part of a program, be essentially give a lot of information, make yourself part of a file in the files of the folks who are essentially garnering funding for what they're doing. I mean, I have some sympathy for the motivation to, you know, get people to assist in ultimately getting funding from the government. But the problem with the programs is it also puts you in a situation where you don't have the freedom to say yes or no, and you get sanctioned if you suddenly start disobeying the instructions of the folks who are running the program, regardless of how unreasonable they may be. And you haven't really got much recourse if you want a place to stay overnight or if you want to eat a meal. So that's happening here in Santa Cruz. In fact, that's one of the issues that HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, has been concerned with making stronger and louder demands about, which we haven't done yet, though, of course, for politicians like Fastlane Fred Keeley or Robert Ratner, the county homeless czar, or the Board of Stupid Vipers, or the California Shitty, I should say the Santa Cruz Shitty Council, the city's legislative body. Anyway, here's the story about San Francisco. San Francisco is walking a fine line over homeless encampments as the biggest international event it's hosted since 1945 is set to unfold this month. As the city rolls out the welcome mat to foreign leaders and dignitaries, CEOs, thousands of attendees, and a crush of journalists, it's attempting to be as aggressive as possible about clearing homeless encampments while trying to connect more unhoused people to shelter and other services ahead of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit set to begin Saturday. And that would be, of course, the day that I'm preparing this show, or yesterday if you're listening to this on Sunday the 12th. But the city must do so while working within the bounds of a federal injunction that limits its ability to remove them. We've talked about this federal injunction in past shows. It's a Coalition on Homelessness lawsuit that says don't remove them unless you got a place for them to go. Leave them be, even if you don't like where they are, unless there's a direct public safety hazard. And simply claiming that there is a hazard is not good enough. What is simply claiming they're engaging in drug dealing or whatever is not enough. You can arrest them for that if that's what you insist on doing, though the drug war has proven to be futile, stupid, ineffectual in dealing with addiction problems or the related problems of people in encampments who are dealing drugs or using drugs. At least that's my opinion. The city did not have the budget, the article continues, to open special homeless shelters for APEC, according to Homeless Department spokesperson Emily Cohen, and I don't believe that. I don't have evidence for it, but I don't believe it. But it's starting its winter shelter program just in time for the event, unlike Santa Cruz, which doesn't have a winter shelter program, opening a 30-spot nighttime shelter Friday at Natoma and 8th Streets, not far from Moscone Center, where the summit is being held. A 30-spot nighttime shelter for how many thousands of homeless people in the city? Additionally, the city is beginning to expand capacity at multiple shelters. It's already operating as part of an existing plan to add about 300 beds between now and early next year. Now, this sounds like what city mangler Matt Huffaker, who titles himself the city manager, was telling me what he was going to do in order to enforce the new sleeping ban, which he's declared since a year and a half since that he is enforcing. I think he made a statement in March of 2022. He would be enforcing the law that essentially makes it illegal for a person to set up a tent during the day or even at night because supposedly shelters and services exist when they don't. It's really the most kind of crass and slimy kind of lying. And essentially victimizing people who are the most vulnerable. And it really pisses me off. Anyway, Cohen said the timeline is still being worked out in San Francisco, so she couldn't say exactly how many of those beds will be available during APEC. The extra shelter space is a convenient tool for city officials as they try to make sure areas closest to APEC are relatively free of large tent camps that could reinforce negative perceptions about the city's often chaotic tent-lined streets and visible drug crisis. The stakes are especially high for Mayor London Breed, who's running for re-election next year and facing at least two high-profile challengers. The Confab is San Francisco's biggest international event since the founding of the United Nations in 1945. The blocks around Moscone will be largely shut down as the federal government implements, here we go, a tightly controlled security zone. Cohen said in an email that the city will conduct dedicated outreach interventions in the vicinity of the conference with teams connecting unhoused people with services, shelter, and housing placements when possible. And there's no discussion of how possible it is or isn't likely to be. This is the PR and also the pretext for the security zone. We're only going after people, you see, in order to put them in shelter, not to remove them so we can make everything look pretty when it isn't pretty, so that we won't discourage tourism by our local foreign guests. When our community hosts events like APEC, we want to put our best foot forward, Cohen said. As always, addressing homelessness requires a comprehensive and compassionate approach. Lots of nice verbiage here. The APEC conference provides an opportunity to spotlight San Francisco's commitment to this issue and demonstrate our city's innovation, resilience, and determination to find lasting and meaningful solutions. Yada, yada, yada. The city's current approach to encampments was on full display Friday morning at Harrison and 13th Streets under the Central Freeway. The area was the site of a sprawling encampment comprising hundreds of tents in 2016, around the time San Francisco hosted events for Super Bowl 50. City crews arrived at the intersection around 8 a.m. Friday to begin the routine. City outreach workers spoke one by one to people who were living in a cluster of tents along the 13th Street sidewalk, trying to get each one placed into a shelter bed. James Green, 46, wasn't sure he wanted one. He had a spot in a hotel-turned-shelter for a few months last year, but said he was kicked out after staying away from the shelter for too long without checking in. He said he lost all the clothes he had stored there, 20 pairs of jeans, some shirts, and four or five pairs of shoes, and didn't want to go through that again. As he began packing up his green tent on 13th Street, tossing empty cans and loose papers into a trash bag while collecting piles of clothes he wanted to keep, Green thought about where he might go next. He knew he wouldn't accept placement into a group shelter where numerous people sleep under the same roof. "I've spent most of my life in prison," he said. "I have problems being around a bunch of people who I don't know. People steal your shit. People harass you. It's all bad. I can't do it." But as the city has tried to help people like Green, officials have had to grapple with how to do so while adhering to an injunction from a federal judge that restricts how the city clears camps. If you want to clear them, you just can't shoot them down like in Gaza, I guess. You know, that's a real problem for sure. Under the injunction, which San Francisco has been fighting in court, the city is limited in its ability to clear encampments without offering residents adequate shelter and from enforcing certain anti-camping laws. The city can still remove encampments with 72 hours notice to ensure access for emergency responders or people with disabilities. That's the pretext. It can also sweep encampments for health and safety reasons. It can ask people to move temporarily to clean the sidewalk or street. But after a recent ruling from the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the city said it was emboldened to ramp up enforcement clearing efforts. An October 18th bulletin from Police Chief Bill Scott detailed a process for San Francisco officers to enforce anti-camping laws against people deemed, quote, voluntarily homeless, meaning they, quote, declined a specific offer of available shelter or otherwise have access to a shelter bed. So in other words, if you're worried and you don't get any reassurance that your stuff isn't going to be stolen and you kicked out if you spend a night or two away, as this James Green fellow claimed, if that's true, then you are a voluntary homeless person, which is, to me, ridiculous. It's not yet clear to what extent the ruling has affected the city's ability to conduct encampment sweeps. Scott told reporters at a recent news conference that during APEC, police were not going to be conducting sweeps. They don't want to see anybody getting shot down before embarrassing our foreign guests, and would plug into our regular infrastructure to respond to homelessness around the conference. "It's not a crime to be homeless," Scott said. "We are out there to make sure that we help people. We are out there to make sure that this is a safe event. But also, we want to represent our city in its finest light." Breed noted at a different news conference that the area around Moscone Center isn't known for having many large tent camps, though the neighborhood does often have unhoused people wandering through the streets who are struggling with mental illness or with drug addiction. Breed also said the city would rely on its traditional approach to homelessness surrounding APEC. "We are helping people. We're getting them off the streets," Breed said. "We're not just going to walk away. We're going to offer support. And if someone refuses, then we'll give them a certain amount of time to pack up their belongings. Or we will pack it up for them and with our bag and tag policy. And we'll do what is necessary in order to clean up and to clear the streets, especially if we have a place for you to go." Jennifer Friedenbach, executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness, decried what she saw as discrimination against homeless people during APEC. "As far as I know, they're not evicting the housed people out of the security zone, but they will be evicting the unhoused people out of the zone," she said. "That's a very unequal treatment of people." Friedenbach said the city should have paid for one-week hotel stays for all unhoused people living around Moscone Center, similar to what the city did during the onset of the pandemic. "They're spending a lot of money on this thing. The entire federal government is involved. At the very least, they should be putting people up with a place to stay," Friedenbach said. Instead, city officials say they're trying to make the most of the shelter spaces they have, and some of these are indeed hotel rooms. Green ultimately accepted placement into one of, as the city cleared his encampment Friday morning. "I'm very happy about that," he said. As the crew wrapped up their work, Green pushed a blue plastic box truck stuffed with his clothes and containers across the street to the sidewalk in front of Best Buy. He said he couldn't take most of the stuff with him. The shelter had a 2-bag limit. on entry. So he planned to leave it on the sidewalk for a while to be supervised by a homeless friend. He would return later to throw away items he didn't need and take the rest. Green sat on the sidewalk for a while, smoking a cigarette and petting his girlfriend's 2-year-old pit bull. 15 minutes later, a white city van pulled up and drove him and the dog away to the hotel. Emily Peretta, 28, who said she'd been living on the streets near the 13th Street encampment for about a year, also accepted placement into a shelter on Friday. She said she planned to start looking for a job when she was settled. "It's a new start," she said. "I feel blessed. I feel lucky." That's the story, Homeless APEC, A Challenge for San Francisco, by J.D. Morris. And, of course, you're not getting much coverage of the people who are getting upset by this, people who are disabled and who are being disadvantaged by this. And you're hearing people who actually have more interest in defending the interests of these folks, Jennifer Friedenbach, the coalition, saying, in essence, that generally speaking, the city is not providing the facilities that they need to be doing, if only for a week, if they intend to relocate everybody, in spite of the court's injunction saying don't do that unless you have real places for people to go. And not just claim that you have a place for people to go, and if they don't take it, they're screwed. They're forced to move. They're forced to abandon their property or try to haul it away somewhere else and perhaps lose it as they do, and then be evicted from that place as the city decides they want to move on them. So that's from the Chronicle of November 6th. Let's take a musical break. So here's a song that's a satire by a guy called Foundering, whose perspective I don't think I agree with, but I don't like the idea that he's being censored. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this song, and then I'm going to play an interview with him from about a year and a half ago, part of an interview. It's a long interview, so I can't play it all. But I also actually ran into this guy who was playing piano at Munch, the cafe that's on Laurel and Pacific, also known as Dregs. He's a pretty wild and crazy pianist. And, well, you can be the judge as to whether you feel this kind of, some would call it hate speech, should be censored. I don't think so. Let's listen to Foundering. The name of the song is What's This?
What's this? What's this? There's wokeness everywhere. What's this? There's pink and purple there. What's this? It's make-believe and weird, uncanny valley. You were Jack and now you're Sally. What's this? What's this? What's this? This world's gone very wrong. I'm pissed. It's why I make these songs. What's this? While I argue with AI, the shills are laughing. Everyone's overreacting. Social media's a trap. And what is this? What's this? There's children changing genders instead of beating kids. There's an anti-white agenda. Just don't say it's by the yips. What's thriving? Vibrant cultures are now foreign occupied. If you're feeling blah in Canada, they'll get you. You are mine. Oh, look, what's this? How multicultural they kiss. Calergy's very pleased, inspiring. They're requiring every vaccination to reduce the population. What's this? What's this? I fear. What happened to Gen Z? They're queer and link before they think. But why? They're blinded by their spy devices. Tiny screens keep feeding all their vices. Don't forget, like and subscribe. So now correct me if I'm wrong. This isn't fun for anyone. If I could fix it with a wish. What's this? Oh my, and how they embrace technocracy. Just see the sleepy NPCs all dreaming of electric sheep. Orwell is grieving, even he barely believes this in his book. Didn't you read it? What's this? Ghislaine and Epstein pedal rings, so missing can't be found. They say the sea is rising, so most everyone will drown. So armed with memes, I'll try to sing sweet magic in the air. The sound of music cuts through the illusion everywhere. At last, the sheep awaken from their sleep. How sweet
beat. They're singing harmony. No more, no monitor, no droning, no conforming to baloney. We're disposing of those phonies. Don't you know I'd win a Tony if I only had the chance? I'd break the trance. Too bad I can't because I'm banned. What is this? Wokeness town.
And this is now an interview by Dissident Mama, who has Foundering as her guest.
Welcome to the Dissident Mama podcast. Today my guest is Foundering. Foundering is the moniker of pianist and singer-songwriter Kylan DiGataldi. With a specialty in ragtime and early jazz, Kylan started one of the first YouTube channels featuring ragtime and stride piano. But Foundering is also known for his satirical songs about conspiracies and other social commentary, some of which have been suppressed, with a few choice ditties being outright banned by the technocratic gatekeepers. Kylan has been a touring member of the international sensation Postmodern Jukebox, with whom he has performed in over 50 cities on 4 continents. When he's not triggering the feels of YouTube and Bandcamp censors or performing live, the Santa Cruz native is also proud. Is also a proud dad to a 10-year-old daughter, as well as a renowned Scrabble player and one of the world's fastest anagrammers. Welcome, Kylan.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Well, we have a lot to talk about. So let me tell folks how I discovered you. It was just a couple of months ago.
Yeah, I'm actually curious myself.
I was writing a little Russia-Ukraine series through a Dixian lens is kind of the going headline. I've done 2 parts. I have a third if I can ever get to it, ready to roll or close to it. But anyway, I was searching up, you know, no Russian ever called me a white supremacist. No Russian ever called me a Nazi, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, okay, I want something to kind of illustrate what I'm trying to say here. And there you go. Your video came up. No Russian ever called me a cracker. And then my Foundering journey began. So I actually linked to, I think it was in part 2 of my series, to 2 of your videos. But since then, I have kind of been binging on your stuff and listening to the deep cuts, because you've been doing stuff for a very long time, some going back more than 10 years. So I reached out for an interview, and here you are 2 months after I discovered you, and I want the whole world to know about you.
Amazing. Well, that's so sweet of you to say. You know, it's so funny that you found me via memes, essentially, because mm-hmm. that's what that concept was, the no Russian ever called me a yada, yada, yada. As an artist right now, I think it's a really exciting opportunity to the mimetic nature of how information is spreading is perfect. If you know how to tap into that as an artist, it is a gold mine. It is a creative gold mine out there. And it can be as simple as reading headlines to reading your comment sections on videos. Some of my best ideas I found have come straight from the comment sections in my videos because of that interplay, that back and forth that a creator should have a healthy relationship with their audience, right? And mm-hmm. when we're dealing with this censorship issue, a lot of times we're in our own little vacuums and it's harder to break out. And as an artist, you suffer as a result because you need that stimulation. You need that back and forth, not just criticism or encouragement. You need the ideas. You need the free flow of information. So you know, we can talk about what censorship does in terms of politics and all that. But from an artist's perspective, it inhibits creativity and inhibits the arts. And I found myself over the years becoming disillusioned with the whole artistic process. I hate to say. I mean, I found myself, I decided I wanted to be a musician about 20 years ago. And when I was mid-teenager, and that journey since, you know, you're supposed to have your up and downs, you're supposed to have your struggles. But when you're going up against the big tech juggernaut, the censorship machine, as an artist, that's yet another hurdle that you have to overcome. When just doing the thing is hard enough. Just coming up with the idea, being comfortable with sharing something, being vulnerable in that way, that's hard enough as it is. But then to wonder, like, am I getting the reach? Am I being shadow banned? Am I all these things? It's the last thing you want to deal with in addition to all. I mean, maybe some people like that. But for me, I kind of got tired of that, the whole process of that. And then when I realized that if you sort of fight fire with their fire and take the things that they are saying you're not allowed to do and then sort of put it back at them in a satirical, comical, I don't know what you want to call it, in a way that is, you can fly under the radar in to a certain extent. And what you were saying, how you found me with No Russian, I remember I actually got that in a YouTube comment. Someone said, hey, your next song, you should just, you should write one called No Russian Ever Called Me a Cracker. And I that's a meme that's been on 4chan and other places. And my first reaction was, that's just silly. That's going to be a really dumb song if I try to, I mean, maybe I didn't have enough faith in myself. I didn't think I could do that concept, do it justice. But then with all this inspiration I've got lately, which we can get into, I sat down and then I wrote the song and I'm like, you know what, this is going to work just fine. And the rest is history. But, just to finish with that thought of memes and how they're powerful. We're in some sort of almost, I don't want to call it warfare, but a mimetic warfare type situation where it's a battle of ideas and concepts. Mm-hmm. And as an artist, musician, social commentator, it is the best time ever to be around. And of course you should know them probably more than anybody else doing what you do.
So. Well, I love satire and I don't think it's done enough well, because it is the one thing that really does get under the skin of, let's say, elitists or whatever, people who wish to control me and you, wherever we are on the spectrum of worldview or whatever. And so many times people won't attack me for what I say. They just say I'm mean. You know, it won't be the content. Is that kind of what you experience, that, oh, you're just mean, stop making fun of people, where they're not actually going after what you're saying so powerfully? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah. Just a probably an extreme example of that. One of the videos that sort of set this whole thing off for me recently, back mm-hmm. in November, was I wrote a song called "You Will Never Be a Woman," mm-hmm. and that one was just kind of a spur of the moment, like literally in the shower. I was in the shower, and this would be hilarious if I write a song, and it just came, "You will never be a woman," and then the rest, I was like, okay, I have to do this. And it was just a joke. It was very tongue-in-cheek, nothing serious, not even mean. If you actually look at the lyrics, it's very tame. Compared to where I went later with some songs, it's very innocuous. But I had some very strong reactions. I'm still getting, I don't know if I would call them death threats, but messages to kill myself and all sorts of stuff just yesterday. I mean, all the time from that video, it's still happening. And one person in particular who actually reached out to my employer, found doxed me or whatever. I mean, I give my name online, but they mm-hmm. searched me out and tried to get me fired for it. They later admitted that they actually didn't watch the song or listen to the song or watch the video. The title was enough for it. The notion, the mere concept that somebody had written a song about this one thing that mm-hmm. angered them so much, that was enough to determine who I was, my person, everything about me.
Wow.
Enough to try to ruin my life, essentially. So that, yes, I can see where you're going with that. And I will say the satire thing, especially during the COVID era, became not just the most effective way to get information out or your message out. It became the only way to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to harken back to the idea of a court jester and how that is very important. The role of the court jester is important now to both the elites and the so-called elites and the rest of us. They like to have an outlet for the anger and the frustrations. In other words, the court jester is the one person who can mock the king to his face and get away with it to a certain extent, right? You can't go too far, but that one person has that permission, and that is good for the stability of that sort of power structure for those in power, because then they can have the peons feel like they have their outlet a little bit. And then, but also it gives them more strength than you would, more power than you think. and especially the jester himself,
mm-hmm.
is a dangerous position, right? You have this fine line you have to walk. And I remember I was we can get into this more, but I was very much in a state in December of 2019 where I was prepared, not necessarily for COVID, but for something very much like COVID, with specifically a viral event that was going to be overblown. I wasn't going to be afraid of it, but I was ready for it. And when it happened and I felt like I didn't do and say enough to stop it, I got a little depressed. Well, I'm a lot depressed by it. I felt like more could be done. Is it not that I could have like prevented it, or could have just, I could have said and done more, you know? And I remember, I think I'm never going to write a song about this. I should write a song, but I shouldn't. And on YouTube, I stumbled on JP Sears, who I've known for a while. And I'm sure you're familiar with JP. And I saw how he was questioning the COVID narrative, but in a way that was, he was playing the role of the court jester. It felt to me like he was being the court jester, where he was clearly being sarcastic and saying absurdities, but in a way that he was getting away with it on YouTube. I thought, yes. It clicked for me. And I said, hey, this is what I need to do. I need to write songs like this. And what's that one line from my song? I'm going to quote myself here. There's certain things you cannot say, so sing them all instead.
Right.
So for JP, it would be satirize them instead. Be play the Joker, be the parody man instead. But for me, I thought, well, hey, I'm most comfortable behind a piano singing, and I have 2 decades worth of songwriting abilities. I can't just throw that away. So I sat down, and I was going to never write an original song on YouTube ever again. That's where I was at that point in my situation. And I wrote Pandemic Dance. I wrote a 10-minute epic about just describing from my perspective what was happening. This was in September or August or September. I wrote this of 2020, pre-vaccine rollout. And I wrote this and I put it out there, kind of thinking a little. I was like ducking a little bit. I'm like, oh, I was expecting maybe a YouTube ban for it because of the climate at the time, but it passed by, and you know, they shadow banned it from search results and all these things, but they didn't delete it. And then I thought, okay, this is something that we can do. And I wrote the election fraud video of the year, song a year later after that happened. And here we are today as I, you know, started speeding up a little more.
So they had said the Pandemic Dance video was hate speech, but just shadow banned it. Never was deleted.
So to clarify, I had 2 videos deleted. So I've been on YouTube since 2007.
Yeah.
I know, right? Can you believe it? In fact, I remember when I was first got on it, I was rolling my eyes at it. People had been trying to get me on it since it first came out, and I didn't want to. And then a friend kind of snuck a video of me, and it was really bad. And back in 2006, I thought, oh shoot, I need to put something up better than that. So in 2007, I started putting songs up, and I want to say that year I wrote a song called The Shining Marquee, and it was a anti-war song. The lyrics maybe not explicitly so, though it does mention war in it, but I remember I wrote this kind of long diatribe in this video description. I mean, this is 2007. I feel like this is I'm not sure of the timeline. I think pre-Google purchasing YouTube. I wrote this long thing, anti-war, saying we need to get out. The guy, Kylan, who I was named after, an next-door neighbor, was killed in Iraq in action, which had a pretty profound effect on me. And so I started writing these songs. In 2008, I wrote a song called Greed, and I called out the banksters at the time because that was during the crisis then. Now, keep in mind, my channel, maybe 1,000 subscribers, maybe less, a few hundred views per video. So it wasn't like I was substantial or anything. But after I started doing that, instead of just doing silly ragtime songs, I noticed my channel was changing. Like I noticed views were being removed. I noticed subscribers going down. I think maybe I was just algorithmically pushed into a certain category of you know, up and coming whatevers. But over the years, I never got any warnings or channel strikes. There were a few videos where it said, "Oh, this." I think my Werner von Braun update. I got a it's not advertiser friendly warning on that one, but and my foil video where I covered Weird Al Yankovic's foil song, and I just basically splurged 10 minutes of random conspiracies into one video, and that was back in 2014. That one was heavily censored. I took apart the metrics of that compared to my SoundCloud and other things. I pretty much showed that it should have hundreds of thousands of views, and to this day it still says 15,000. And I think it actually it should even have about a million views. That's a separate thing. So to get to what you asked about the pandemic dance, I had never had any strikes on my channel for content. There was one time last year when I was streaming silent films on Twitch, which was great fun. I did it for a few months where I would put on a old Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin film and have my piano and I would play live as people watched it in the chat. And it was just a blast. It was a lot of work, but it was super fun. Great challenge to play for 2 hours straight and make it up on the spot. But for musically, it was crazy. I got better little by little, but I tried to upload that, some of those videos onto YouTube, and YouTube gave me a copyright strike for just uploading a silent film that was in the public domain. And I even had the Wikipedia page that said, this is in the public domain. And I used my own soundtrack. But the crazy thing is not that I uploaded it and then got the strike. It blocked me from uploading it and gave me the strike anyway. So it gave me a strike for even just trying to upload it. It didn't say, hey, this is owned by somebody else. So that's when I knew that YouTube was not going to be playing nicely with me. And it was a huge blow to me at the time where I was doing all this work for these silent films and writing my own soundtracks. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a way to share them because Twitch deletes them after a certain period of time. And mm-hmm. I couldn't share them on YouTube. So now I'm uploading them on Odyssey, my Odyssey channel, okay. Which I'm loving Odyssey. I haven't been doing any new ones, but I'm uploading slowly all the old ones I did on Twitch last year. So other than that one copyright strike on my channel, I wanted to put that out there. I didn't have any problems until January of this year. I think on the 5th, they updated their terms of service. YouTube did, and they were warning they were going to do it, and they were going to come after COVID misinformation, but yada yada yada. And I remember counting down the days to that and thinking I'm in trouble because I had just uploaded Oy Vey Shut It Down, which was I had written as a troll essentially to YouTube to try to forced them to take it down. So I was in this position of, I just trolled YouTube. They're updating the terms of service. I really did expect my channel was going to get deleted on January 5th. I thought it was a good chance at least. So I wrote a song called Alex Jones Was Right, and I dumped it as fast as I could onto YouTube just in case it was my last song. And then on the 5th, I got a note from Google saying that I had two videos that were removed. Now, here's where I wanted to clarify. The pandemic dance was not removed for hate speech. It was removed for medical misinformation, which is hilarious because it's a song. I know I picture that Bryson Gray, I think who was him, was some rapper that had mentioned COVID being a hoax or something in a song, and he got his song removed. So it's not like it was totally unheard of, right. But my song in particular was clearly like satire. It was not like I start the song singing that JP Morgan and John Rockefeller conspired to sink the Titanic to start the Federal Reserve together. That's how I set the tone. Like, never mind that Rockefeller and the Morgans were against each other at the time, and like there's clearly things going on there. I'm setting the tone, right? I'm setting the mood of the piece that don't take everything I'm about to say seriously. It's what I did with Foil back in 2014. And let me tell you, the internet of 2014 was different than it was now. I mean, we got Obama as president. It was putting that video out there at that time was risky for me. And I had a lot of friends and colleagues kind of look at me like, what are you doing here? So I when I made that video, I realized I could do a trick. And the trick was you can get away with saying uncomfortable truths and controversial things if you surround them with clearly farcical or ludicrous notions, if that makes sense. So here with, I am with aluminum foil, it was like a test. I was like testing YouTube, like testing the waters a bit. I'm singing about things like the NSA watching us, things like the assassination of Michael Hastings, the journalist, things like this that are like kind of serious issues. But then I'm also, the next very next line, I'm saying Keanu Reeves is the king of the vampires. Right? That he's an immortal, like there is an actual conspiracy that Keanu Reeves isn't necessarily a vampire, but he's an immortal being. And there's pictures that people found back in the 1500s of a guy who is like spitting image of Keanu Reeves. So again, I'm just singing a song. I'm throwing every single conspiracy. I'm a data guy, right? I'm a pattern I'm an anagram solver. I like to just look at all the combinations of things, and some of the letters fit and make words.